Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
Hotel History is created for adult audiences. Content may not be suitable for all listeners. Discretion is advised. You're listening to Hotel History. We take you with us through the sordid history and scandals of some of the world's most famous and infamous hotels. I'm Dieta.
And I'm Yael. Let's get started.
It's that time of year again. Fucking Christmas.
I like Christmas.
I do too.
I like Christmas because I'm so, what's the word? I'm Christmas deprived. You know, I didn't celebrate growing up, so. So wherever it was, I'm like, I love it.
Slurp it up.
I'm in the store. I'm like, yeah, play that music.
I know. I finally am ready for Christmas music. I've been listening to it in my car when I drive.
It's fun. I don't know. Everyone gets sick of it, but it makes me feel good. Also, Jews wrote it. So yeah, I'm supporting my people.
Exactly. When I just saw that we love the blogger Messy Nessie, and I saw that she has a Christmas music playlist on Spotify, so I just followed it. I'm gonna go listen, and I bet it's really good.
Yeah. Okay, we have to tell them that we're listening to their music. Yeah. So today we're gonna discuss something appropriate for the season, and also appropriate for our history. Which is, we're working on the title. What's the title? Are we going to go with Divine Lodgings?
Sure. Heavenly Stays.
Rosary Beds.
Rosary Rooms.
Holy Hotels.
Yeah.
That's a good one.
Praise in the Penthouse. Prayers in the Penthouse.
Prayers in the Penthouse. Prayers in the Penthouse. That's good. I'm thinking of the Jesus, like, crackers and wine. But
communion?
Oh yeah. Comfy communion is one, or blood, flesh, and pillows.
Ooh, okay.
I don't know. What do you guys? I don't know these things.
What do they do?
No, because the blood of the blood of Christ.
Yeah.
And then the crackers, the flesh.
Yeah.
And then pillows.
Yeah, no, I got it.
Okay.
You didn't have to explain it.
Okay, I thought I got something wrong.
No, just...
So we're talking about hotels that are in old monasteries, basically.
Yeah.
And other holy places.
Yes. This episode will be about Christian monasteries specifically, but I really want to do another episode about Buddhist monasteries because I saw some really cool Buddhist monasteries.
Oh, okay. Yeah. That would be really fun.
So we're going to start with one that is important to actually three faiths. We're going to start out around Mount Sinai in Egypt, at St. Catherine Monastery, whose official name is the Sacred Autonomous Royal Monastery of St. Catherine of the Holy and God-Trodden Mount Sinai, is a Christian monastery located in the Sinai Peninsula of Egypt. So I think that St. Catherine's is what we're going to go with. Located at the foot of Mount Sinai, the alleged Mount Sinai, I should say. It was built between 548 and 565 CE and is the world's oldest continuously inhabited Christian monastery. Controlled by the Autonomous Church of Sinai, which is part of the wider Greek Orthodox Church, the monastery became a World Heritage Site in 2002 for its unique importance to the three major Abrahamic religions, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, and the monastery includes even a Fatimid mosque built in 1106 that is still preserved.
Wow. By the way, when you look at pictures of this monastery, it reminds me of when we spoke about the Persian.
Oh, the caravanserai.
The caravanserai, yeah. It has very similar aesthetics.
Yes.
I mean, in how it's built, a little similar, and like it looks like a walled off.
Yes. It's definitely a place. Fortress. Like yeah, this place is a fortress in the desert.
The backdrop of St. Catherine's is the three mountains. And the mountains are Willow Peak, Jebel Arenzieb, and Mount Sinai, known as Jabal Musa in Arabic. Centuries after its foundation, the body of St. Catherine of Alexandria was said to be found in a cave in that area. The relics of St. Catherine, kept to this day inside the monastery, have made it a favorite site of pilgrimage.
The monastery was built by order of the Byzantine Emperor Justinian I, enclosing what is claimed to be the burning bush seen by Moses. So originally, there was a chapel there, the Chapel of the Burning Bush, which was also known as St. Helen's Chapel, which was because the Empress Consort Helena, the mother of Constantine I, had ordered this chapel to be built to enclose and keep safe the burning bush. Then Justinian decided, let's just build an entire monastery around this chapel to keep it safe.
You know, that is one way to preserve your relics.
Yeah, absolutely. Just put it in a house and put that house in another house. St. Catherine's Monastery also encloses the Well of Moses, where Moses is said to have met his future wife, Zipporah. The well is still today one of the monastery's main sources of water.
Oh my God, really?
Yeah.
That's so cool. The history, it's like crazy. Why isn't this more popular of a place to go in Egypt?
I think it's a little difficult to get to. It's like very southern Sinai Peninsula. Mm. And I think you have to like arrange everything to get there by yourself. It's not like a major tourist site. So there's not a lot of infrastructure.
Okay. The site was already an important pilgrimage site by 100 CE due to its association with the biblical narrative of the Exodus, and monks lived there before Justinian founded the monastery. The oldest record of monastic life at Mount Sinai comes from the Itinerarium Ageria, a travel journal written in around 382 CE in Latin by a female Christian pilgrim from Ageria. St. Catherine was born in Alexandria towards the end of the 3rd century and was educated in philosophy, rhetoric, poetry, music, mathematics, astronomy, and medicine. That is a good, well-rounded education.
Especially for a woman, yes.
Yeah. I wish I was that educated.
I know.
She was renowned for her beauty, her aristocratic birth, and her wide learning. That's probably why she had a good education. Her aristocrat.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yes.
Rejecting all offers of marriage, she was converted to Christianity through a Christian hermit who lived in the outlying deserts. Okay.
I feel like there's more to that story right there.
For sure.
And I would like to know what it is.
Yeah. She's like, I want to be a free woman.
But also, this hermit's kind of cute.
Yeah.
I like the rugged beard he's got going.
He looks like Moses. During the persecutions of Maxentius in the early 4th century, she confessed her faith in Christ and condemned the worship of idols. The emperor appointed 50 rhetoricians to argue with her, but her presentation of Christianity was so brilliant and her condemnation of the pagan religion so devastating that they were themselves converted to Christ. Damn!
That if it pleased the court.
Yeah. St. Catherine resisted all the emperor's promises, threats, and tortures and was at last beheaded for her faith.
You know what this actually reminds me a lot? Have you ever seen, I can't remember the name of the movie, but it was about the Greek female philosopher Hypatia.
Yeah. There's a movie about her?
Oh, yeah. It's a great movie. It sounds like the movie Hypatia, except opposite, because Hypatia refused to become Christian.
Oh.
But she, and so she was tortured and killed by the Christians, whereas this woman refused to stay pagan.
That's very interesting. I think that we just continue on the generational trauma and revenge cycle.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it sounds like.
But both live in Alexandria, so very interesting parallels there.
Interesting, yeah.
So St. Catherine's memory is celebrated on November 25th. Following her martyrdom, angels bore her body to the peak of Mount St. Catherine until it was translated or moved somehow to the Catholicon, which is a big chapel of the Holy Monastery of Sinai. The veneration of St. Catherine spread throughout the West, especially after the translation of her relics to Rouen. I don't know where Rouen is, but sounds French, by Simeon Pentagloss in the early 11th century. The numerous pilgrims to the monastery from that time resulted in the gradual change of the name from the Holy Monastery of Sinai to that of St. Catherine's Monastery. So now the relics are in a shrine in her honor that was constructed by Procopius, the stonecutter, which took 9 years to complete. And that replaced the earlier marble chest that her relics were in. But they still have the marble chest in the monastery's treasury. Inside are two precious reliquaries given by the Russian Empire for this purpose, one enshrining the head of the martyr and the other her left hand. The relics of St. Catherine are brought out for the veneration of the faithful on special occasions.
It's like the brain of Einstein. Kind of.
Kind of.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so we've been doing this for a long time. In the second year of the Hajira, corresponding to A.D. 623, a delegation from Sinai requested a letter of protection from Muhammad. This was granted and authorized by him when he placed his hand upon the document. The letter of protection is known as the Athiname, from the Arabic words ad, which means obligation, and name, which means document testament. Several certified historical copies are displayed in the Library of St. Catherine, some of which are witnessed by the judges of Islam to affirm historical authenticity. The monks claim that during the Ottoman conquest of Egypt in the Ottoman Mamluk War from 1516 to 17, the original document was seized from the monastery by Ottoman soldiers and taken to Sultan Selim's I palace in Istanbul for safekeeping. A copy was then made to compensate for its loss at the monastery. It also seems that the charter was renewed under the new rulers, as other documents in the archives suggest. Traditions about the tolerance shown towards the monastery were reported in governmental documents issued in Cairo and during the period of Ottoman rule, from 1517 to 1798. The Pasha of Egypt annually reaffirmed its protections. Wow. So getting your document blessed by Muhammad is the way to go.
Yeah, you really wanted that in this time of
conquest
and later crusades and whatnot. You really wanted someone that said, "Hey, leave these monks alone. They're fine."
I mean, yeah. Why you gotta be bothering monks? Out
really?
Of all people, they just want to live in their little space in the middle of nowhere.
They literally went to the desert to get away from all of you. They shouldn't have to ask for protection to be left alone. And that's how I feel about me.
Yeah. Just leave me alone.
As an introvert who just wants to be left alone.
Oh my God. You just nailed it on the head. Monks were just the introverts of our past.
Yeah.
They were like, fuck this. You guys talk way too much.
They're like, I cannot recharge my battery. You know what? I have found God and I must go. No. Do not follow me.
Yeah.
No.
God told me that you need to shut up.
From the time of the First Crusade, the presence of crusaders in the Sinai until 1270 spurred the interest of European Christians. It increased the number of intrepid pilgrims who visited the monastery. Its dependencies in Egypt, the Levant, Syria, Crete, Cyprus, and Constantinople supported the monastery. Throughout the Middle Ages, the monastery had a multi-ethnic profile, with monks of Arab, Greek, Syrian, Slavonic, and Georgian origin. However, in the Ottoman period, the monastic community became almost exclusively Greek Orthodox, possibly due to the decline and depopulation of Transjordanian Christian towns.
The monastery's library, founded sometime between 527 and 565, is recognized by Guinness World Records as the world's oldest continuously operating library. Wow.
Yeah.
Really? It preserves the world's second largest collection of early codices and manuscripts, outnumbered only by the Vatican Library. It contains Greek, Christian Aramaic, Syriac, Georgian, Arabic, Ge'ez, Latin, Armenian, and Church Slavonic. All of these in manuscripts and books, along with very rare Hebrew and Coptic books. The monastery library holds unique and rare works, such as the Codex Sinaiticus. Is that how you say it?
Sinaiticus.
Sinaiticus?
Oh, I've got Sinaiticus.
Okay, so... You do have Sinaiticus.
We cannot take anything seriously, okay. God.
Okay, so it has rare works such as Codex Dieta Sinaiticus and the Syriac Sinaiticus, as well as a collection of early Christian icons, including the earliest known depiction of Christ's
Pentocrator.
Pentocrator. Is that a dinosaur? I'm pretty sure.
Christ Pentocrator is a powerful image of Jesus Christ as the almighty ruler of all, a central icon in Eastern Orthodox Christianity, depicting him as a stern, majestic king and judge, often holding the Gospels and raising his hand in blessing, representing his divine power and role as sustainer of the world, with the oldest surviving example at St. Catherine's Monastery. In May 1844 and February 1859, Constantine von Tischendorf visited the monastery for research and discovered the Codex Sinaiticus, dating from the 4th century, at the time the oldest, almost completely preserved manuscript of the Bible. The finding from 1859 left the monastery for Imperial Russia in circumstances that had been long disputed. But in 2003, Russian scholars discovered the donation act for the manuscript signed by the Council of Cairo and Archbishop Callistratus in 1869. The monastery had received 9,000 rubles as a gift from Tsar Alexander II of Russia. Okay, good. So they didn't steal it. However, the codex was sold by Stalin in 1933 to the British Museum and is now in the British Library, along with literally everything else from everywhere.
Okay, that's very interesting that Stalin sold it rather than burnt it.
Yeah.
But he probably needed the money.
He needed the cash, yeah.
Yeah, that's what happens.
The complex houses irreplaceable works of art, mosaics, the best collection of early icons in the world, many in encaustic, as well as liturgical objects, chalices and reliquaries, and church buildings. The large icon collection begins with a few dating to the 5th and 6th centuries, which are unique survivals. The monastery was not touched by the Byzantine Empire's iconoclasm when they destroyed so many, and it was never sacked because of its protection, and it's a great fortress, and it's in the middle of nowhere. So that's why they have this amazing collection.
Man, imagine. I want to see all this stuff.
Looking at the photos, it looks like it's definitely out there. It is the desert. It is like a mountainy, rocky desert. But the photos of the sunrises are incredible. And you can hike up to the top of Mount Sinai. There's an old mosque up there and an old Greek church up there.
Oh, wow.
As well. Yeah, at the summit. Okay, so if you want to go here and you want to stay at this monastery, because you can't stay inside the monastery proper, but there is a hotel right next door specifically for pilgrims and tourists to stay in. All rooms have private facilities, and the cost of the room includes dinner and breakfast. There's a spacious courtyard, there's a snack bar, and they do have mostly rooms like for single or double occupancy and a few for more. It does seem like it's a little tricky to figure out how to get your room booked. Because when I went and looked, there's a website called monasteries.com where you can book different monasteries to stay in, and they didn't have any openings. So I don't know if they're super busy and booked or if they're just not taking things right now. A lot of websites also said that the hotel is not run by the monks. It's run by a local Coptic family. And so that you have to reach out to the family to book. So you might have to do a little bit of digging and research to figure out exactly how to stay here. But all of on like TripAdvisor and stuff, it has pretty decent reviews.
Yeah. I wonder if also they're available on Airbnb.
Possibly. Yeah. And remember, this is a monastery. So this is not a luxury stay. It's going to be pretty much the basics because you're supposed to be there for spiritual enlightenment.
Yeah.
But a lot of times monasteries offer extremely competitive rates and they're just as good as a budget hotel.
Yeah. I mean, it's so, and just staying in a place with such history is like, talk about it. I don't think it's haunted, but you're going to feel things. I feel like there's things happening.
The atmosphere there is probably going to be very different than your travelodge. So
yeah. You're not just gonna have like a Bible on this.
Just going to a site where people have been making pilgrimage for thousands of years is pretty
So our next hotel, I actually got to see.
I know. I'm so jealous.
You should be. It was a lot of fun. Okay. I went to Belgium this year in the summer and I got to explore some areas. I was staying in Antwerp, but I took a train to Ghent and I just was walking around. I wanted to see some of the sites, but also I wanted to see the historic hotels. And I happened to pass by this. I thought it was a real monastery. I thought it was still working. And I'm like, I'm just going to hop in. But then I think I saw a sign of hotel. I'm like, what's going on? And I thought I was going to a religious site. So I was kind of nervous. I went in and then I look on the walls and there's nuns, pictures of nuns. But they're like really beautiful. And I'm like, that's interesting. I didn't know nuns were hot. Then I look closer at these like portraits of the nuns and they're made up of tiny images of underwear, of women in underwear.
What?
Yeah, I showed you this.
Okay, I feel a lot less bad about being a little bit irreverent about saints and their relics if literally this hotel took their monastery and put nuns up.
But they made it's subtle. It's not like glaring in your face. It's not like a total, you know, distasteful thing. You have to look and then you see it's literally made up of pictures of women in their underwear, and it's just the underwear, and some of them are, there's no underwear, it's just a tushy.
Oh my god.
Yeah. And I was like, wait a second, I'm like, do they know their pictures are like this? Like the nuns are gonna freak out if they saw. Then I realized, I was like, oh, this is a hotel. This used to be a monastery. I ended up talking to the front desk, who was so nice. And then I ended up talking to I don't think he was the manager, but he was the marketing guy or someone who works there. And he gave me a tour and we had a great conversation. And I'm like, so are they okay with these pictures? And he's like, yeah, they love them. They think it's hilarious. So I guess nuns have seen it and they're like, haha, good one.
Nice.
Because they know it's not a functioning monastery. But that's how I came across it. And shout out to them. They were so nice to me. And when you go in to the front desk, they have like iced tea and like little things. It was really cute.
That's so nice.
And it's preserved really well. And it's gorgeous. And it's a great place to have a party. I can see like a really fun rave happening in there.
Yeah. Yes. Oh, I love that. Well, so it has a pretty decent long history as well. So in the Middle Ages, Ghent was actually enclosed by several canals that were meant to protect the town from the dangers that threatened its inhabitants. A lot of medieval towns were like this. So near the gate, which is poort in Dutch, leading into the town, there was a field, akker in Dutch. So that's why it's called the Poort Akker, because it was the field near the gate.
Just get straight to the point.
Yep. In this field, a complex for beguines was built. So a beguine was a medieval laywoman in Western Europe who lived in a semi-monastic community, serving God through prayer and work without taking permanent vows, offering a religious life outside traditional convents.
What do you mean, not taking permanent vows.
So they don't become nuns. They don't actually take vows and abstain from the good stuff.
Oh, they have their cake and eat it too.
Yes. Yes. So they get to live like together communally in a monastic life, but they can still,
you see, I would have signed up for that.
Yeah. But so then if they do decide to get married or remarried or something, they're not breaking any vows. They're not leaving the, you know, that sort of thing.
So it's just seminary.
This complex for the Beguines was also called Port Acker by the people of Ghent. So it's been called this for a very long time. In one of the walls of the building, there is an 18th century stone, which reveals that the Beguine house was founded in 1278.
I saw that and took
a
picture.
Did?
Yeah, I'm going to share it.
That's so cool.
Yeah.
Not long after this, a chapel and a churchyard were added, and Port Acker mainly housed older and sick Beguines. Oh, that's probably why they needed to set up a life together, because they didn't have anybody else to take care of them.
Yeah. Also, if you're in Ghent, you can take a river tour because of the canal tour. Highly recommend. Lots of fun. And you see every angle of Ghent.
Oh.
It was really beautiful. Ghent is gorgeous. You're going to a different world. Well, all of Belgium, Antwerp too, is really nice. When during the French Revolution, all cloisters, churches, and Beguine complexes were seized by the town councils, the Council of Ghent confiscated Port Acker. In 1863, the site was sold to the Count Joseph de Hempton, a Catholic industrialist and a great patron of the neo-Gothic movement. With his permission, a congregation was housed here. At first, there were plans to restore the old buildings, but in the end, a new neo-Gothic cloister was built. Most buildings of Port Acker date from that period. A new chapel, two inside gardens, and an orphanage became part of the complex. It's a really beautiful, and I don't know if I saw every single area, but I saw the main areas and wow.
After World War II, the site was successively an orphanage, a house for young women, and a student residence. In 1998, there were still six nuns living there, but due to the extravagant maintenance costs, the buildings were sold. Do you think that they let them take those pictures of them to try to pay?
They're like, we have a way for you to save your monastery.
Thanks to private initiative, the site has been transformed into a hotel, guest rooms, seminar center, and a restaurant.
Yeah, you could rent out, I think, the main room that looks like where the church was for all these events. And it's really well preserved. We have to share. I really want to share the photos that I took because.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
They were really nice. But also those nuns that were living there. Come on. How old do you think they were that they would be able to sell their photos to save the monastery? Maybe if OnlyFans exist,
right? Only nuns.
Only nuns.
That absolutely would have an audience. That is such a fetish.
Yeah.
We have one more for you. This is the Santa Maria de Montserrat Monastery. And this one is still a functioning monastery. Located in the mountains of Montserrat, rising majestically in the Catalonia region of Spain, about 37 miles northwest of Barcelona, is a Benedictine abbey, Santa Maria de Montserrat, a mountaintop sanctuary surrounded by Montserrat Natural Park. Montserrat literally means serrated mountain in Catalan, and the jagged, needle-like peaks make for a dramatic backdrop to the monastery.
It's gorgeous. I looked at pictures.
Yes, this one looks really cool.
This one really, you look like you're in the middle of nowhere.
The Montserrat Monastery has its roots in the 9th century when a group of Benedictine monks established themselves in this remote and mountainous location. The choice of this place was not accidental. The monks sought solitude and spiritual communion with nature. The isolated location and the breathtaking natural beauty of Montserrat provided the perfect setting for monastic life and contemplation.
Over the years, the monastery experienced periods of growth and decline, but its importance as a religious center never waned. During the Middle Ages, Montserrat became a significant center of learning and culture, with its library housing an impressive collection of manuscripts and artworks. I feel like these libraries have to be the most amazing places.
So, monastery libraries are incredible, they still find things in them to this day that either they thought were lost forever or that they didn't know ever existed. Like the things that are stored in these old monasteries are so crazy. And like the monasteries back, especially in the Dark Ages and the medieval time period, they were like they hoarded all of the knowledge, and they were the place where everything had to be kept and transcribed. And so they have so much stuff that even they don't know what they have.
That's crazy. The foundation of the monastery is attributed to the Benedictine monk, Abbot Oliva. So Abbot Oliva, who led the construction and initial organization of the monastic community. As the monastery grew in size and influence, significant expansions and renovations were carried out, resulting in the beautiful structure we see today. The architecture of the Montserrat Monastery is a marvel in itself, with its design harmoniously blending with the shapes of the surrounding mountains. One of the highlights is the main basilica with its soaring Greco-Byzantine dome, where the Virgin of Montserrat, a revered and beloved figure for millions of pilgrims, resides. There is a Virgin of Montserrat?
Yeah, we're going to talk about her story in a minute.
Okay.
Montserrat is enveloped in an intriguing legend. And by in a minute, I mean now. So Montserrat is enveloped in an intriguing legend involving the Virgin of Montserrat, also known as La Moreneta, which means the Little Dark One. The legend goes that shepherd boys discovered an image of the Virgin Mary hidden in a cave in the Montserrat Mountains in the year 880. That's a very specific year for a legend, can I just say? When the nearest bishop wanted to move the image to the city, the image became progressively heavier, and it was decided that the image would stay on the mountain and be worshipped there. And this is like way up on the mountain. I can see them being like, nah, let's not drag this to the city. The figure of the Virgin earned the name La Moreneta due to her dark skin, and she became a symbol of hope and devotion for the Catalans. The 38-inch wooden statue shows evidence of Byzantine conventional and stylized form and is painted in polychrome. The reliquary statue of Saint Foy in Conques, southern France, may have been a model. Conques or Conque? Probably Conque.
I thought it was Conquest.
Sorry, France. The art historical designation for this type of pose is called Throne of Wisdom. The body is thin, the face elongated. She holds an orb of the earth in her right hand. The child's hand is, this is a statue of the Virgin and the child. The child's hand is raised, the child is Jesus. I don't know if, I feel like I shouldn't need to say that, but.
You always need to say that with me because I'd be like, what child?
Yes, this is Mary and Jesus. The child's hand is raised in a formalized and traditional Eastern blessing. So this image is now in the, I don't guess it's a cathedral, but it's like the main.
Is it made up of tiny little pictures of women on underwear?
It is not. This one is a little more of a classic icon.
Okay.
So in 2001, renovators working for the government observed that the black hands and face of La Moreneta had over the centuries undergone a change in color. They attribute the change from a lighter tone to black, either to prolonged exposure to candle smoke or a chemical reaction caused by a varnish used as a paint sealant. They also figured out that the statue has been repainted black by successive generations of restorers. So like once it turned a little bit dark, I guess they were like, we want to keep it this way. So they just kept painting it. A series of tests, including x-rays, revealed the statue's original color and also showed that the last repainting took place at the turn of the 19th century.
Okay, well wouldn't you want to just clean off the dirt rather than paint it black?
Yeah, because if the smoke and stuff turned it black, then it's going to continue to be dark. So I'm not really sure what the point of repainting it is. But there aren't very many black Madonnas in Europe, and this is one of the more famous ones. So maybe they just wanted to make sure that it kept its allure for people to come look at it. The Virgin of Montserrat is widely venerated and is the patroness of Catalonia. In September of 1881, Pope Leo XIII declared the Virgin the patron saint of Catalonia.
In 1811 and 1812, during the Peninsular War, French troops led by Napoleon invaded Spain and burned down and looted the Montserrat Abbey twice. Why do you got to do it twice?
That's just adding insult to injury.
During these attacks, many of the Montserrat Monastery treasures were sadly lost. Well, yeah, they got burned down twice.
Yeah.
Why? But why do you have to do that?
It makes no sense to me. Like, why would you do that to a monastery? They're not part of your war, most likely. I don't actually know.
But what did they, like, okay, you go in, you barge into the monastery. Let's say you go and you start fighting with the people and you win. And now you have a monastery.
Yeah.
What are you...
And it's like up in the mountains. What are you going to do with this? This is not strategic for you. Like, why do you? I think they did it on purpose. They probably had some good stuff in their treasury and they wanted to go steal what was in their treasury.
But then why would they burn it down?
Because people are assholes.
Yeah. Well, men. During the Spanish Civil War in the 1930s, several monks at the monastery were killed along with other religious individuals. After the war, Francisco Franco was Spain's military dictator, his rule characterized by repression, nationalism, and alignment with fascist powers during World War II, suppressed regional cultures like Basque and Catalan, and political dissent. The monastery served as a place of refuge for scholars, artists, politicians, and students. I feel like that could be also making you a target.
Yeah, that I wonder if that was why they got burned down during Napoleon's war.
Yeah.
But classically, that is where people would go to seek refuge, because when you seek sanctuary in a church, used to, churches were
off-limits.
Sacrosanct. Yeah, yeah, off limits. Nobody was going to burn down a church. But as the modern world came into being, people didn't care anymore.
Yeah. Montserrat is also famous for its boys' choir, one of the oldest in Europe, the Escolania de Montserrat.
You know what? I meant to go on Spotify and see if they've recorded anything, because a lot of these monasteries with really famous choirs have started releasing music.
Also, monasteries were a place that many Jews would put their children in to save them. And some of them, well, they pretended they weren't Jewish. Either some of the monasteries knew, or some of the individuals there, and others. I was watching a show. She would dye her child's hair blonde, like, and visit her once in a while and be like, you're going to just continue to pretend not to be Jewish. Yeah. The museum has art collections of Goya, Picasso, and Dalí, and an archaeology collection. Montserrat is also a popular hiking destination. Two historic mountain rail funiculars start adjacent to the monastery plaza.
Ooh, oh, we love funiculars.
I want to go here. Saint Joan,
which is the name of one of the funiculars.
Oh, okay. Saint Joan climbs to 1,000 meters. Santa Cova descends to the Grotto trailhead. Both offer vistas of the Catalan pre-Pyrenees. By the way, funiculars are the best.
They're so cool.
I was so stupid. When I was in Paris, me and my friend, we went to, there's the Basilica on the Hill. Like, it's very famous. Mount, I don't remember what it's called. But we hiked, we climbed the stairs and I was dying and we were starving. And I'm like, and then finally I'm like, let's go down. And we found the funicular. I was like, wait a second. Was this here the whole time?
I would have
climbed down the stairs rather than up the stairs.
Yeah.
But it was dark and you never know.
Yeah. So if you want to stay here, they do have a hotel. Hotel Abad Cisneros Montserrat. It is a 3-star hotel that sits at the very heart of the monastery. It's located inside a building that has been the provider of accommodation for pilgrims to the monastery since 1563. In the late 1950s, the old monastery building was converted into a hostel, and then in 2000, more conversions were made, turning it into this hotel. So even though you're not staying in necessarily a monk's type room, you will be in a very nice hotel that has been being used by pilgrims for 500 years.
That's fun.
And I was looking at photos, and even like the dining room is in a room with one of those, like, where the ceiling is basically one giant arch. So it looks, it very much, you will feel like you are eating dinner inside of a monastery.
That's cool. That's like you're at a cave. Which one would you stay at?
I would stay at all of them, obviously. I am torn between, I think I want to go to Montserrat first because its views look stunning. Yeah. I want to ride the funicular and I want to stay. I want to visit the monastery, but I want to stay in like a little bit nicer of a room, but still feel like I'm staying in the monastery. But then after that, it would be St. Catherine's in Egypt for sure. Yeah. Like, I want to go there so badly for all of the history that is there. But I think that one's going to be a little trickier to find.
Yeah. And so, then you're also, that's all you're doing. Yeah. I would say at Montserrat and then at the Port Acre.
So what are some reasons that people might want to stay at a monastery or somewhere that used to be a monastery? What's the draw?
I would say it's cheaper, simple. You feel like almost like the people there will take care of you better. They see you more as a human rather than just like a person paying for the room,
yeah,
I would say. And then also if you're religious.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah. Those would be my top reasons.
Yeah.
What about you?
Mine would definitely be the how cost effective they seem to be, but also the amount of history that is at a monastery. You're just going to be surrounded, like the very walls are history. And also I think that because they are such centers of spiritual contemplation, I think that the atmosphere in them would be incredibly calm and soothing.
It is.
Yeah.
When I went into that hotel, it was very calm, very calm. And it's Ghent. I mean, it's a pretty small, in my opinion, like, city. It's not that big, very walkable, but and this hotel was like on a side street kind of, and you just felt really, really calm going in. It's like you're in a different world.
Yeah,
it gives that feeling. It would be really cool to film a movie there.
Ooh,
if they ever need a space, they should go there and they should pay me the location fee.
Thanks for listening to Hotel History. You can follow us on most social media platforms, Patreon, and Substack by searching for Hotel History or Hotel History Podcast. To connect or collaborate with us, check out our website at hotelhistorypodcast.com. If you like what you hear, please leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts and Spotify so we can reach more listeners.